Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead this hour, trying to teach civics at a divided time in our nation's history. Add the pandemic, remote learning, and it's a tough job for teachers. We'll hear more. Standardized testing will be taking place in Illinois schools. What might the results show? We'll also hear from an Illinois woman. She contracted COVID-19 and became the first in the country to have a double lung transplant. Environmentalists are pleased to see coal plants being shuttered, but without clear rules for tearing them down, another concern is being raised. And a new state law makes changes in the criminal justice system. Some in Illinois law enforcement and others are critical, saying it puts crime victims at risk. But many advocates see it differently.
This notion that you can't have a justice system that is fair and impartial, that also provides justice to survivors, is just simply not true.
Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, would banning violent video games in Illinois help reduce carjackings? That's the idea one lawmaker has. We'll find out more. We'll also head into the classroom to learn more about teaching civics in a highly divisive time. And with a very disruptive year for students, what will standardized testing show? That's just some of what we have for you on this week's Statewide. First up, people with underlying health conditions can now get vaccinated in most of Illinois, but some say their lives won't go back to normal anytime soon. Vivian McCall brings us that story.
Mike Altergott could have died last February, and it wasn't the first time. He has Crohn's disease, a condition where an overzealous immune system attacks the intestines, causing scar tissue and blockage. Crohn's is very painful and deadly if left untreated. Altergott eventually needed surgery to remove a foot of intestines and has taken an immune-suppressing drug since 2014.
That inherently causes you to be susceptible to infections, right? Like every other of my 31-year-old friends who've gotten COVID, they've all gotten through it just okay. I might not get okay, and there's a very real chance that I might not.
Altergott received his first COVID vaccine dose yesterday and cried with relief. Still, he's extra strict about quarantine, and it's going to stay that way for a long time. A really long time. For most people, the vaccine is more than a drug. It's hope life can feel like life again, that the end of lockdown is approaching. The CDC now says fully vaccinated people can gather unmasked, indoors. But immunocompromised people have to remain more careful. For them, the vaccine is an extra cushion of safety, not a free pass to change their lifestyle. Altergott worries he could still be vulnerable even after he's fully vaccinated and can't afford to be reckless while the virus is still out there, something he's seen others do.
And that is deeply distressing to witness. We must continue that mindset of protecting the vulnerable and protecting others, right? And I would challenge those people who challenge the benefits of wearing masks and distancing. You know, have they experienced loss in their life? Do they want to be responsible for that kind of loss in someone else's life due to their negligence?
Loken Lee is a fashion designer. At the start of the pandemic, she thought she was healthy until she was hospitalized in August after 5 nonstop days of the spins.
And a student doctor burst into the room. He looked over the radiologist's shoulder and he saw the lesions on my brain and he goes, "This is great news. We figured it out. You have MS, just like your mom."
MS stands for multiple sclerosis, when the immune system attacks the protective coating around nerves in the brain, causing a communication breakdown between them and the body. It's like a rat chewing on wires. Every 6 months, Loken gets an infusion that completely wipes out her B cells, leaving her incredibly vulnerable. She's a student at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago and took one in-person class this semester. She kind of regrets the decision, but is jealous of peers who can push the limits of their safety. This is new to her. She still has to remind herself a bus ride could kill her.
There will be days I go without thinking about it, and I kind of forget about it. And then I remember, and I'm like, this sucks. I still have this thing looming on my shoulder, in my brain, in my head, literally.
Normal life is still far away for Loken. Friend hangouts are out, but she's lonely and misses her family back in Seattle. She hopes to visit once she's vaccinated, despite the risk. all the immunocompromised people I spoke to know at some point they'll have to pick and choose between acceptable risks, because staying inside forever has real consequences for their mental health. Patricia Lee has stage 4 breast cancer. When she gets the vaccine, she'll visit her son in L.A. because her first grandchild is due in April.
After the vaccine, hopefully, you know, even though if I do get the virus, I wouldn't die from it. I would maybe get sick with my, you know, condition. I don't know how long I could live. You know, stage 4 cancer is not very hopeful. They don't have a cure for cancer yet, so.
For now, she's quarantined with her boyfriend. She used to be an usher at church, a caretaker for her daughter in a wheelchair. She misses all of it, but can't risk any of it right now. Waiting for the world to reopen is hard on everyone, but harder for those with serious medical conditions, because mortality is always looming, even without a global pandemic. Vivian McCall, WBEZ News.
The Biden administration has announced schools still have to do standardized testing during the pandemic. Peter Medlin has more on why, with many students struggling, schools are itching for any way to better understand where they're at academically.
Dr. Lynn Gibson says even Illinois superintendents are about 50-50 on whether testing could provide helpful insight on how well students are doing or if it's a complete waste of time. She's a superintendent and clinical assistant professor at Northern Illinois University. Is there something in between a waste of time and a useful measure of student learning?
I'm not sure if there is a middle ground, frankly.
Most Illinois students are learning in a partially remote blended format, and plenty of families across the state have opted to keep their kids fully remote.
In a time when we don't have a lot of time with our students, it's hard to take more time, you know, a couple weeks to administer and then sending them off.
She says the last thing schools want is for students' futures to be dependent on some exam during a global pandemic. And Biden education officials have discouraged states from using these tests to decide if students can move on or not. Maurice Davis thinks there might be a middle ground as long as schools use the test as a single data gathering tool among many others, like local assessments and day-to-day classwork. He's the executive director of schools at Rockford Public Schools.
It's not an easy answer. It's not a yes, we should do it, no, we shouldn't. We have to really be thoughtful about what are we gaining, what are we not gaining, what can we glean from this.
He says they've been discussing how they're going to do these tests for weeks, but the conversation is still ongoing as to what's the best way to test kids in different situations. Is it even a standardized test if some students have to do it at home and others do it in short sessions in a classroom? Dr. Gibson says, probably no.
Doing, quote, standardized testing under a non-standardized environment doesn't seem to make sense.
School leaders from several states, including Illinois, have sought waivers so districts don't have to give these tests. But those blanket waivers aren't coming. The administration is only offering them the flexibility to do the tests remotely or over a longer period of time. But can the tests even be seen as a reliable data set? Dr. Gibson says that many have just had to shrug their shoulders.
If it turns out that it can be done with validity, then maybe this will help us with another data point to help us understand where our students' learning is. None of us can answer that question, though.
Learning loss is at the heart of this debate. The idea that students are having trouble learning during COVID-19 and are falling behind academically where they would be otherwise. And plenty of schools have reported students failing classes more than usual. And the new administration is also giving schools relief funds for summer programs to help them catch up. But teachers have pointed out that they're already used to helping kids at very different levels in a single classroom. That's why when you ask Dr. Gibson, if these tests are such a bad idea, how do you measure student success then? She says you turn to their teachers, who will have that understanding of if they need additional help or intervention.
Not a new thing for us. We're working with human beings, so there's different ways to teach reading, and there are different ways to learn math, and some of those click with some of our students, and some other methods click other ways. We may need to focus on that more now with more students, and we always are getting better at it.
Maurice Davis agrees. He says they need to be fearless and trust students and allow them to have more of a voice in their own education.
The kid has the opportunity, if they so choose, right, to become part of that decision making and be able to say, hey, listen, like I could show you my learning in this way.
The tests were canceled last year because of COVID, so it's been almost 2 years since they've been done. And it's reignited the underlying controversy of standardized testing. Whether they're a good barometer of learning at all, or just, as research points with the SAT, that your district is more wealthy and can devote more resources to test prep. Dr. Gibson says, whatever your mileage is on testing, she hopes there's one thing schools won't overlook this spring.
I'm not sure everyone's remembering that the teacher-student relationship and their time together is the most important.
And with millions of students away from their teachers for nearly a year, most in education agree. If long periods of testing come at the expense of that relationship, it's hard to justify. I'm Peter Medlin.
A deeply divided country makes it harder for social studies teachers to do their jobs. Politics has always been a difficult subject in the classroom, but teachers say it's essential now for students who understand how to talk to someone they disagree with. All of this, on top of remote learning and hybrid instruction, makes already hard conversations even more challenging. Lee Gaines takes us to the classroom.
Okay, let me put my specs on so I can see who's here. Okay, Lily's here. That's awesome. We got all our live people.
Kelly Keough takes attendance in his social studies class at Normal Community High School in Central Illinois. About 10 students sit in front of him. The rest are doing remote instruction. Each group takes on a different lesson for today. With his in-person class, Keough begins a discussion about polarization in American politics.
What's the magic word that we find in the Constitution? They predicated the entire document around this word. And I think if we look back at that film, there's a word that former Speaker Boehner couldn't even bring himself to say in the course of an interview. Yeah.
Compromise.
Compromise. Okay.
Keough asks why compromise is a dirty word. One student suggests a politician could be accused of selling out their party. Then Keough brings up a former student, Republican Congressman Adam Kinzinger.
I think Congressman Kinzinger had members of his own family who wrote a letter saying just that, he has sold his soul?
Yeah.
The congressman was in the spotlight recently for supporting efforts to impeach Donald Trump.
So not only now are we talking about having a different political viewpoint, you're now talking metaphysically about selling one's soul and eternity if you have a different point of view. So we got some big problems here. How are we gonna
Keough has taught history and social studies since the mid-1980s. He says political polarization has gotten worse, and it's seeped into the classroom.
Today, I mean, if you announce that you're on this side of an issue, very often you're immediately, the communication shuts down. And so trying to get my students to hear an opposing viewpoint and be open, it's a challenge.
I think this level of political polarization is different than anything that we've faced before.
Diana Hess is the dean of the School of Education at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
I think it is much more challenging to teach civics now than it has been in the past, but it's also, I would argue, much more necessary.
Hess studies how middle and high school students learn about politically controversial issues. She says schools aren't to blame for political polarization, but they could be a part of the solution. The key, she says, is teaching students how to talk to and respect the political views of those they disagree with.
And I do think overall, we will find that if lots and lots of young people are taught how to do that should at some point begin to have an effect on political polarization.
But Hess cautions that not all views deserve respect, like those based on misinformation or racist ideology. So educators also need to teach students how to become critical consumers of information. Tracy Freeman has shifted the way she teaches over the last decade. She wants to train her students to challenge their assumptions and remain open to other perspectives. Freeman teaches social studies at Normal West High School across town from where Kelly Keough teaches. After the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, Freeman says she heard from a former student. They told her they went to Washington that day for the Trump rally, but made it clear they didn't go into the Capitol building.
And just wanted to talk again, just wanted to say like, hey, I came for the rally because, and this is someone who shared that they were a fan of President Trump's, not necessarily a Republican.
Freeman didn't criticize the former student or tell them what they did was wrong. Instead, she asked them to reflect on what they learned in her class about charismatic leaders and why blind loyalty to anything or anyone is a problem.
My goal was not to make him not be a Trump fan. My goal was to get him to critically think about being in a situation out of loyalty to a person that could have ended up very badly for him.
Freeman says part of her job as a teacher is to stay connected to her students as they develop and question their political opinions. 17-year-old Andrew Harrell says polarization is present at his own school, Belleville East High School. It's in southern Illinois, about 30 minutes from St. Louis. Harrell is a senior who loves his civics class. He says his education has taught him to be a more engaged citizen. But he's upset by the conversations he sees on social media, where people don't actually talk to each other, they just trade insults.
And if there's no, you know, consequence for it, and if there's no push to communicate in a friendly or respectful way, then it will just drive our country further apart, and that's how a democracy will fall.
Harrell hopes that a quality civics education can teach more young people how to talk respectfully to people who hold a range of opinions. His classmate, Mariah May, is also a 17-year-old senior. She says polarization is a divisive force in her community, and it prevents students who disagree with each other from spending time together.
Like, the pandemic hasn't really helped with that either, because a lot of people have become comfortable going online to express how they feel. And they become less likely to approach how they would a situation online in person.
May says she hopes a civics education can help normalize respectful, in-person political discussions between people who disagree.
All right, guys. Hey, so real quick, will you spritz your desk? Clean off your desk. Another thing of COVID land.
Kelly Keough, the teacher from Normal Community High School, says the pandemic has made it harder to engage students in tough conversations. Some of his full-time remote students keep their cameras turned off during class, so Keough has never even seen them.
It's almost impossible to have effective discussions, especially on controversial issues, when you're not having any eye contact.
Keough says those challenging classroom discussions are easier when students are in person. But even then, they're wearing masks. That makes it difficult to interpret facial expressions. But Keough is committed to fostering debate among students, so they'll have the skills they need for the future. I'm Lee Gaines, Illinois Newsroom.
Thanks for being with us here on Statewide. And a reminder, our website is statewideshow.com. You can find links to the stories you hear each week. There's more on the way. We'll hear from a researcher who says more money for state and local governments in the latest COVID relief measure is needed. And that's next on Statewide. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, a St. Louis neighborhood with a long Italian tradition. It's known simply as The Hill, and a new documentary tells its story. Most congressional Republicans have argued that about $350 billion for state and local governments in the latest COVID-19 relief measure is unnecessary, that it's a bailout for states and municipalities already in financial trouble, Illinois included. Amanda Cass is the Associate Director of the Government Finance Research Center at the University of Illinois Chicago. She co-wrote an article on the topic in Governing Magazine, arguing that state and local governments do need this relief funding, and she spoke with Brian Moline.
What we were noticing is all the analysis about whether or not state and local aid is needed has been hinging on the revenue side of the ledger. The revenue side is just one kind of side of a budget. And really no attention has kind of been paid robustly on the spending side and getting a really clear and robust evaluation of the full needs tied to COVID. Assessing need entails some kind of subjective decision-making about, you know, what do we constitute a COVID-related expenditure? Are we only kind of thinking of need in terms of immediate kind of emergencies? Are we thinking about kind of long-term, some of the long-term consequences of COVID and needing to combat that? We think that the $350 billion is absolutely needed. And I think for us, the question was, do we have the right metrics to even evaluate whether this is sufficient?
Yeah, one argument that Republicans are making here is that there's still unspent money for this purpose from the CARES Act that passed last year. If so, where is that money?
Right. So what we noted in this is we think this is kind of a false narrative that's being perpetuated because of some data reporting issues. The Treasury Department is kind of only collecting information on how state and local governments have spent the money. So in other words, they're only capturing money that's gone out the door right now, but they're not taking into account kind of what state or local governments have planned to spend that money on. In many cases, the money has, at the local or state level, there's already a plan to spend the money. It might not have technically happened at this point, but that doesn't mean the money isn't needed or planned for a use.
One thing the two of you point to is the aftermath of the Great Recession. It's kind of a cautionary tale about what happens if we don't do enough for state and local governments. Can you remind us what happened there?
You know, we had a massive financial crisis in 2008. And one thing that I think is important when we're thinking about the current moment is with the last recession, the kind of depth of the impact on local governments' budgets lagged many years after the formal recession ended. Kind of one lesson to me is that the fiscal impacts of a crisis can often last much longer than the economic downturn. And so we should be kind of mindful about that in the current moment and when we're thinking and evaluating whether aid is sufficient. And then kind of one of the big lessons from the last recession is that federal aid programs that were created to combat the Great Recession, they kind of ended early. So they ended when it looked like when there were some economic indicators that, to suggest that, okay, there's economic recovery happening. And what researchers have now found is that ending the federal programs early ended up kind of being a drag down on the economy and dragged out recovery longer. Like one of the lessons of the Great Recession was don't end federal programs early.
That's Amanda Cass, Associate Director of the Government Finance Research Center at UIC. You can find a link to the article she co-wrote. That's available at statewideshow.com. There's been a lot of hype around carbon markets for farmers. They can make money off the carbon their plants naturally remove from the air. But as Katie Pikus with Harvest Public Media reports, there are still questions about how much of a difference these markets can make.
Kelly Garrett likes to experiment.
Yes. On December 8th, it was 60 degrees.
So he went out to plant 35 acres of soybeans. A couple months later in his workshop in Dow City, Iowa, Garrett says he wants to see if the soybeans will grow bigger and if he'll get better yields. Of course, that's if they survive the winter.
Everybody thinks it's crazy, which it probably is, but we're not going to know unless we try.
Garrett's also experimenting with carbon markets. As part of photosynthesis, plants pull carbon dioxide from the air. They take the carbon, turn some of it into plant tissue like stems, leaves, and roots, and leak some of it out through roots into the soil. All plants naturally do this, but tilling can quickly send carbon back into the air. Garrett, on the other hand, doesn't till. He also rotates crops and he composts.
I think they all lead to better soil health, which leads to better yields.
Big corporations like Amazon are trying to offset their greenhouse gas emissions. So they're buying carbon credits from sustainable farmers like Garrett.
The market is already showing a growing willingness to pay for high quality carbon credits.
Carrie Hernandez is Indigo Ag's global head of carbon operations. That's one of the startups helping farmers get paid for carbon. Hernandez is speaking during a recent webinar pitching different carbon markets.
And demand is on the rise and supply is slow to catch up.
Demand because many large corporations have committed to reaching net zero carbon dioxide emissions. But the science behind how much agriculture can reduce carbon dioxide emissions isn't clear. Farmers need to take on a new practice to be able to earn carbon credits. But Iowa State University soil scientist Marshall McDaniel says there's not always an immediate effect.
After a farmer makes a change in management, it just takes a long time for there to be a detectable difference or detectable change in soil carbon.
As for how long carbon can stay in the soil, McDaniel says that's a tricky question. He says there's always carbon going in through plants and there's always carbon leaving.
But there's other forms of carbon, plant carbon, that stick around in the soil for thousands of years.
McDaniel says some of these conservation practices improve soil health and enable it to store more carbon. But in the larger picture, agriculture is just one part of the solution to reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Madhu Khanna is a University of Illinois professor.
It is an important part of the solution, but we need the rest of the sectors, rest of the economy to be contributing as well to reducing emissions by reducing fossil fuel use.
The transportation and electricity sectors release more greenhouse gases than agriculture does. But Khanna says it's great to see carbon markets emerge as a way to reward farmers for capturing and reducing emissions. And Kelly Garrett, the Western Iowa farmer, has already been rewarded. As of early February, he's made $115,000. Canadian e-commerce giant Shopify bought 5,000 carbon credits from Garrett for what his plants have been storing over a five-year period. Garrett says he's only invested a few hours of his time to earn that money.
The fact that I can sell these carbon credits is just a bonus to me. It's a great bonus, a great added income.
And Garrett's looking to sell more carbon credits on the market. Every farmer is eager for extra money, but it'll take a lot more farmers and a lot more industries to have a large impact on climate change. Katie Pikus, Harvest Public Media.
As energy from coal falls out of favor, more plants across Illinois will shut down. The state has 23 of the power stations, and half of them are already closed. They're now starting to be demolished. But Eric Schmid reports environmentalists worry because there are not clear rules for how an old coal plant should be taken down.
Tony Oplett first noticed the Wood River Power Station in East Alton was being taken apart in the fall of 2019. The Edwardsville resident chairs the Metro East Green Alliance, a local group focused on environmental issues. She says she was curious about the demolition, but struggled to obtain details from the property's new owner, Commercial Liability Partners.
Finally, after about the fifth email, I got a response. And that response said, we're doing everything we're supposed to do. Thank you very much. They would never meet with us. They would never talk to us.
A spokesperson for Commercial Liability Partners says the company will follow all current safety regulations. Oplett's curiosity about the demolition here quickly turned into fear after another one of Illinois' shuttered coal power plants came down in April 2020. A smokestack implosion at the Crawford coal plant in Chicago shot a thick cloud of dust over the city's Little Village neighborhood, a working-class community mostly made up of Mexican and Central American immigrant families. Edith Tovar is a community organizer with the Little Village Environmental Justice Organization, or ELVEJO.
A lot of our departments within our city was reassuring us that, you know, all the right precautions were taken, yet there were zero water tanks on site to try to diminish the cloud of dust from traveling that far.
Experts say that dust can carry mercury, arsenic, and other heavy metal byproducts that come from burning coal. Tovar says the demolition was traumatic for those around the neighborhood, especially because residents were already coping with the stress from coronavirus lockdowns. Just like Oplett, Tovar says ELVEJO struggled to get information about the demolition, even as the plant was being taken apart. She says many of their questions remained unanswered afterward.
We had nothing. The city of Chicago had nothing to really share with us. IEPA also had really nothing to share with us.
Environmentalists saw what happened in Chicago and now worry the same kind of disaster could strike again at one of the many remaining facilities in the state. Half of Illinois' 23 coal-fired power plants have closed since 2009. Five more, including one southeast of St. Louis in Baldwin, are supposed to fully come offline this decade, and the remaining six are either shuttering some units or have no official retirement date.
We're hitting this big transition moment. All these power plants are going to close.
Andrew Rain is a civil engineer at Prairie Rivers Network, an organization that works on water, land, and pollution issues across Illinois.
We just don't have a plan, and it's coming. Across the state.
Only three coal plants have seen demolition activity so far, according to a spokesperson at the Illinois Environmental Protection Agency. For the remaining plants, there aren't statewide rules for how a company must handle a demolition, besides meeting national emission standards for asbestos. Oplett says she learned this when contacting local officials and those at IEPA asking what regulations exist ahead of the Wood River Power Station demolition, which started last month.
Not once could anyone ever definitively say this company will have to be accountable. They were often pointing us back and forth, you know, at each other.
Tovar says ELVEJO's experience was similar, even after an environmental failure.
There was this just pointing fingers and blaming whichever department had to sign off, right? And the matter of fact is that everyone is to blame for when it came down to the botched implosion. There should be consequences.
She says the developer there ended up being fined 60 $68,000 by the city of Chicago and paid another $370,000 to settle a case brought by the Illinois Attorney General.
These are all very low fines for a disaster that they caused.
Most of Illinois' coal-fired power plants are in more rural areas away from cities. But there are some plants in metro areas, like the Wood River Power Station, whose smokestacks are still standing. They will come down after the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers finishes evaluating how their demolition might affect nearby levees. Opelet and Rain worry they'll release toxins into the air when they come down. Rain says all communities with a coal plant deserve to know they'll be safe when these power stations are eventually demolished.
You know, it's a transparency issue of like really understanding what does this process look like and how can people protect themselves. If there's no process, there's no way for the community to know what's going to happen.
He says more demolitions are inevitable, and without any regulations, more environmental problems are too. I'm Eric Schmid.
The coronavirus pandemic has wreaked havoc on the film business, with movie theaters closed or observing strict capacity restrictions to deter spread of the virus. It's also reshaped the film festival circuit, where smaller, independent films have a chance to thrive. That change may have proven a boon for a documentary called America's Last Little Italy. It's about the St. Louis neighborhood known as The Hill. And St. Louis native Joseph Puglio directed. He spoke with Jeremy Goodwin.
The big thing with COVID that, you know, at first we thought was going to be a huge detriment was going to be with our festival run and the fact that, you know, we're not going to have that in-person experience. But what came of it was incredible, the fact that so many people from across America, from Italy, started buying tickets for our film to watch it at the festival. Whereas in a typical year, we would have just got, you know, we would have sold out the Tivoli or wherever they would have shown the film. People would have came, they would have watched it, they would have left, and that would have been the end of it. And it would have been all people from St. Louis. And then if we went to New Haven, it would have been all people from New Haven, which is a festival that we got into, or Little Rock. The fact that these festivals became virtual now gave us the opportunity to reach beyond just that region. And so we started getting people watching it in Chicago, watching it in New York. We can't wait till the pandemic is over and we can come and visit The Hill. That started in July and hasn't stopped to this day. I still get these messages, you know, on a daily basis from people that are now finding the film on Amazon. And, you know, the places that you would assume would have the most pushback, New York, Chicago, things like that, they're the people that are the most excited about this and can't wait to come visit.
You mean people who might, you know, be proud about where they're from? And
exactly.
Little Italies in America are pretty much gone. Many in other cities cling to the concept of Little Italy. It's merely a facade of what it used to be. Maybe it's one block long now, where there's mostly Italians, or two square blocks long. Or you still have a series of Italian restaurants in the area.
They don't know. They don't know because they've never heard about it and they've never been here. Now this film is giving, you know, kind of shining a light on this neighborhood. This film is now has the opportunity to educate people that this neighborhood does exist.
Joseph Puglio started shooting interviews for the film just a matter of days after executive producer Rio Vitale pitched him the idea for a documentary about The Hill. Puglio says that with a generation of Hill residents getting older and the pandemic looming, the film wouldn't have turned out how it did if not for that speed.
A lot of these elderly residents on the Hill in the neighborhood were starting to pass away. So every time one of these Hill lifers passes away, we're losing the stories with them.
Yeah, Joseph, at the end of the film, we learned that 10 of the people we had just heard from in the film passed away in 2019 and 2020.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I mean, it was an emotional experience for us to, you know, have these conversations with these elderly residents of the Hill. And sitting there with these interviews, watching these interviews day after day, you begin to really know these people. These people become, you know, extremely close to you through that process. And for us to have lost, like you said, 10 of these members, it's been something that's emotional to us, but also, you know, kind of proves the point that, you know, how important this was for us to get these stories while we had the opportunity.
Yeah, when you see those faces at the end of the film, there's a real sense of this history moving beyond living memory, like in front of our eyes, and capturing that while it's still there.
Yeah, for us, that was the selling point, was, you know, the fact that we were losing these people, and you know, we have to do this while we still can.
That's filmmaker Joseph Puglio discussing his documentary, America's Last Little Italy, about the Hill in St. Louis, and he spoke with Jeremy Goodwin. You're tuned in to Statewide. We've got more coming up. Stay with us. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, a state lawmaker wants to ban violent video games. We'll hear why. That's still on the way. In the early months of the COVID-19 pandemic, 28-year-old Myra Ramirez contracted the virus and ended up in the ICU. The virus severely damaged her lungs, and her doctors concluded she would not survive unless she got a double lung transplant. In June, Myra, who's from Illinois, became the first U.S. patient to undergo the life-saving procedure. She spoke with Side Effects Public Media about what she's been going through in the past year.
My name is Myra Ramirez, and I live in Bridgeview, Illinois. I had my transplant on June 5th, and I was inpatient at the hospital for a few weeks after that. Woke up, didn't recognize my body, couldn't move, couldn't really breathe. And after that, you know, I went to Shirley Ryan, the rehabilitation center that I went to for physical therapy and occupational therapy, speech therapy. I did a lot of, you know, day-to-day things like brushing my teeth. I wasn't able to do before brushing my hair and, you know, just walking, a lot of walking and showering, bathing myself. I thought at the beginning, everything was just so fast. Every single day I was improving. I was being able to do more than I was the day before. You know, that kind of hit a plateau and then started to decline. And that's due to an infection that I contracted. But it got really bad. I had this awful cough, fevers, chills, a lot of fatigue, nausea, vomiting. And turns out that a CT scan showed that I have an infection in my sternum where bacteria is eating away at my bone. The bacteria is really rare and it's really hard to treat. What they did was they went in and scraped off like the infected bone, like scraped off like the infected skin as well. They did that twice before closing it up. And that was at the end of last year in November. So now we're just trying to get better, waiting for my scars to heal, you know, dealing with letting my body heal again. I feel like at the beginning, I was so much more hopeful, like I'm going to get back to myself. You know, this is just a minor inconvenience. I felt like I had some hope that things would get better. And now it just feels like not. In the beginning, I had a lot of anxiety attacks, a lot of panic attacks, but I'm dealing much better with that now. I'm doing much better in my job. I'm a paralegal at an immigration firm. I help people obtain immigration benefits. Not only have I been back, but I'm also taking like leadership roles. I'm holding more responsibilities. I feel useful. I feel like I have a purpose and I feel like I can still help others. The hardest part are the physical impediments. The more I try and the harder I try, the more I realize that I'm never going to be back to myself, but I can just be happy and grateful for honestly just being able to use the bathroom by myself and just being able to continue my work. Maintain my health insurance. I'm honestly just happy to be alive.
That's Myra Ramirez, the first COVID-19 patient in the U.S. to receive a life-saving double lung transplant that happened last June. That story produced by Christine Herman. Thank you. Governor J.B. Pritzker's proposed budget for the next year would skip out on $350 million supposed to be doled out to schools under a 2017 education funding law. And as Hannah Meisel reports, some of Pritzker's fellow Democrats are pushing back.
In order to get traditionally underfunded schools up to parity, the 2017 law requires the state funnel $350 million more to schools year over year for a decade. But Governor Pritzker's budget would skip it for the second year in a row. State Representative Will Davis, a Democrat from Homewood, chairs the Illinois House's Education Appropriations Committee and says school funding should be more like mandated state payments to Medicaid.
I just want to see if we can treat this education conversation kind of in the same vein.
While signing an unrelated education bill on Monday, Pritzker defended his budget.
My budget proposal preserves our increased investments in education, foundational to a strong and vibrant future for the state of Illinois.
Education advocates worry the state won't be able to catch up with its funding equity goals. I'm Hannah Meisel.
An Illinois state representative wants to ban violent video games. He says they contribute to increased carjackings in Chicago. It is far from the first time state lawmakers have taken the idea for a test drive. Christine Hatfield has more.
Illinois and other states have tried and failed to pass bans on those kinds of games in the past. Experts say the new bill isn't realistic. Marcus Evans Jr. is the state representative behind the bill. He's a Southside Chicago Democrat. Evans says he worries games affect mental health, especially among young people.
The thought is, you know, do they think this is acceptable behavior, you know? And I'm looking at things that are, you know, supportive of carjacking and looking to oppose those things and just bring the question of the acceptance of certain behaviors.
Evan says some people are impressionable, and he says there need to be conversations about the standards being set in American society.
With Trump grabbing women by their, you know, genitals and insurrections, you know, where are we going as a country? What's acceptable?
Evan says he wants to have discussions to improve his community. The debate whether video games lead to real-life violence is not new. It's also a question researchers have tried to answer for years. In 2005, University of Illinois professor Dimitri Williams put out what academics called the first long-term study whether there is a link between video games and violence. The study didn't find any strong effects, but the debate goes on. He's now an associate professor at the University of Southern California, Annenberg. Williams says there are other well-documented causes of crime, and he says video games have become a red herring to sweep away uncomfortable conversations.
Games are no panacea. They're both good and bad, just like, say, television or books have good and bad. It's not an all-or-nothing kind of thing.
The same year as Williams' 16-year-old study, then-Governor Rob Blagojevich signed a bill into law that would have prohibited sales of violent video games to children. Retailers and gaming companies took the bill to district court, where judges overturned it on free speech grounds. Joyram Chakraborty is an associate professor of computer science at Towson University in Maryland. He co-authored an article on the connection between public policy and video game violence. Chakraborty says even setting aside the court rulings, he's not sure lawmakers understand the dimensions of modern video gaming.
We're growing faster and faster, and technology is moving faster and faster, and everything is moving faster and faster. But yet the laws and the requirements and the support mechanisms have been struggling to keep up, and they're continuously going to struggle to keep up.
State Representative Marcus Evans Jr. is standing his ground. He says because studies are based on individual experiences, he's not sure studies on video games and violence tell the whole story.
Everybody has a different reason for committing a crime. You know, some people are impressionable, but some people are, you know, trained criminals. I mean, there's all different facets of reasons why someone is choosing to participate in deviant activities.
Academics differ. If the connection between video games and real-life violence does exist, Joyram Chakraborty says a ban probably isn't the way to go.
There are different ways to approach this rather than, I'm going to ban it because it worked 10 years ago and they failed and I'm going to try it again. Because that's the classic definition of insanity.
Evans says he hopes the law and society have swung his way since the last time this was tried. Chakraborty has an alternative. He says educating people on sensible computing from an early age could help them make informed decisions for themselves. He says nobody can make you a good or bad driver. It's about offering the choice.
And we give them the tools and then let society make their own decision going forth.
He says it wouldn't be the finishing point, but he says it would at least start a conversation. I'm Christine Hatfield.
The U.S. Supreme Court has weighed in on this topic. In 2011, the court ruled that video games, just like other forms of media, are protected under the First Amendment. Republicans and law enforcement groups in Illinois continue to decry a landmark criminal justice reform package that was signed into law earlier this year. They say provisions in it, like the elimination of cash bail, put the public at risk, especially survivors of rape and domestic violence. But as Maureen McKinney reports, advocates for survivors say the system often doesn't look out for their best interest and the new law could actually benefit them.
A man was arrested for domestic battery and had to appear in Cook County Domestic Violence Court. He paid his bond and was released. Then he was charged and arrested again while out on bond. Those cases were still pending when he was arrested for violating an order of protection.
I just bonded out over and over and over and over again and kept violating.
Melanie McBride is a managing attorney at the Metropolitan Family Services Legal Aid Society. She says the situation shows flaws in how the criminal justice system handles domestic violence now and makes the case for a revamp. A revamp like the one outlined in Illinois' recent criminal reform laws, which included the landmark Pretrial Fairness Act. When the law takes effect in 2023, it will end the use of cash bail in the state. Supporters say the act put safety first. Associations of sheriffs, police chiefs, police unions, and state's attorneys came out in force to oppose the measure before the governor signed it. GOP Representative Patrick Windhorst of Metropolis, who is a former state's attorney in Massac County, says the reforms may be detrimental to victims of domestic violence.
There is no middle ground, and judges may be reluctant to hold someone in jail on a misdemeanor offense without bond. We'll have to see how it works in practice.
The cries from conservatives to support survivors ring hollow to Amanda Pyron. She's executive director of the network, which operates the state's domestic violence hotline.
In actual fact, survivors gain quite a bit through the Pretrial Fairness Act.
Plus, Pyron says the current cash bail system preys on Black and Brown communities through overcriminalization of offenders and survivors alike.
This notion that you can't have a justice system that is fair and impartial that also provides justice to survivors is just simply not true.
One change that supports survivors is expanding options for getting an order of protection, options that are limited now.
You've got places in Illinois where survivors have one day a week they can get an order of protection. And now with criminal justice reform, they could get an order of protection at a bond hearing at any point.
Republicans warn that other changes to bond hearings could be harmful to survivors of sexual assault. Illinois House Minority Leader Jim Durkin recently panned a provision that states a defendant has the ability to compel complaining witnesses to appear and testify at a bond hearing.
To stand in front of the judge and also within a few feet of her attacker. This is not how we should treat victims of crime in Illinois. It is morally wrong, and it also is in direct conflict of the rights of crime victims and witnesses.
Sarah Stout of the Appleseed Center for Fair Courts says in Cook County, those bond hearings now can be as short as 2 to 5 minutes. They're usually the day after an arrest, and that means prosecutors don't have time to talk to domestic violence and sexual assault victims at all. The new law says when there's a possibility of a defendant being jailed, there's a 24 to 48 hour waiting period.
They have time to go talk to the victim on the prosecutor's side, and on the defense side have time to figure out what the situation is with the person who got arrested, what their family situation is, what their employment situation, other things that are relevant to whether or not jail should be used, since we would only want it used as a last resort.
Senator Robert Peters, a Chicago Democrat who sponsored the measure getting rid of cash bond, says opponents are not listening.
The facts are that our current system doesn't do enough to look out for survivors.
Some of the changes to the system are still being worked out. A risk assessment tool for judges is part of what's under the act, as is a task force on how domestic violence cases should be handled. I'm Maureen McKinney.
That's all the time we have for Statewide. Thanks for joining us, and be with us next time. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. All of our episodes are available at our website at statewideshow.com. Our weekly podcast can be heard through the NPR One app. Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.